This is a production of Cornell University.
for graduate assistance. And I'm sure many of you have heard a lot about this. I know it's been a hot topic in people's email boxes. And what I'd like to do is just talk a little bit about the process and then save some time to answer questions about the election process or the steps that will unfold over the next week or so. So for context, many schools across the country are having similar discussions right now. There have been elections at a number of peer programs. And one thing that sets Cornell a little bit apart from what we've seen at some other campuses is that in May of 2016, CGSU and the graduate school, and the university signed an agreement that laid out a number of principles and specific steps and understandings around how the election would take place. And so we have this document, it's on our website, we sent out a number of emails with links to that, but this is really our guiding document describing what an election would look like at Cornell. And that was, that agreement was formed at in recognition of the fact that while some schools have taken a rather adversarial approach to student unionization, Cornell took a slightly different tack and said that what we want to have is an engaged, thoughtful, informed discussion, and the university would allow students to make their own decision around unionization. So that's really the guiding principle. Since that time, the NLRB has ruled in August, as most of you know, that graduate assistants do have the right under NLRB regulations and law to form a collective bargaining unit, and CGSU has presented cards of sufficient numbers to call an election. The election is scheduled for March 27th and 28th, so that's next Monday and Tuesday. So now is just a week before the election. I just want to talk through really quickly what you can expect, and then I'll open the floor up for questions. The agreement lays out most of the logistics, and so really what we're talking about now are logistics. The election will be held, it will be overseen by the AAA, the American Arbitration Association. And they will be our neutral election adjudicators. And the process is well described in the document. If you have specific questions, you can look at the agreement. The CGSU and Cornell have agreed to certain communications. I think most of them have now gone out. You've received, those of you who hold assistantships have received emails about your FERPA rights and whether or not you wish to have certain information disclosed. You've also received information that the notice of election, so that's the official notice that it is taking place. At this point, the real energy is around turning out the vote. And I think one of the founding principles, one of the first principles articulated in the shared agreement between Cornell and CGSU is that we want students to all feel that they can vote and make an informed decision that's in their own best interest. So I would expect that you'll see a fair amount of discussion and promotion from people that have strong feelings on either side and from people who just wish to have a strong showing that voting is important. So one of the things I think it's important to understand is that the results of this election will be binding on all eligible graduate student assistants, even if the showing is rather small. And if you have a feeling about how the results should play out, you should be engaged in that in voting. So why don't I stop there and open up for any questions about the election process.
And I'll just clarify, vote for Jason and our next speaker. The Q&A sessions are going to be just like if we're presenting a resolution, pretty much. You just address the question to the speaker, and I'll recognize you. If you're in the back, you can also ask a question, but since we don't have a name, black card or anything like that, I might have to say, the guy with the blue and white shirt or something. And we'll go until
if there are ballots that are being disputed, and the ballots and the number of disputed ballots could tip the scales in one direction or the other, it could take more time.
What forms of identification do students need to bring to the polls, and does it have to have their first name or preferred name or?
Yeah, great, great question. We learned a little bit from Harvard here, where they had some trouble with preferred name or versus birth name. So you need to have either a government-issued ID or a Cornell-issued ID card. The poll workers will be provided with students' official registered name and also their preferred name as it's in the system. But if you have a nickname that you go by that's not, if you have your Cornell ID or your official government-issued ID, you should be fine.
If you are unsure of your eligibility to vote, who should you contact?
The messages that will be going out, they already have gone out in some cases, but there'll be more messages. We've sent messages to students that are in the unit, and there'll also be a message, continued messages sharing where polling locations are. Each field will be assigned a polling location. There are four on campus and one in Geneva. We are also preparing a communication that will go out to students who are not eligible, because we're hearing this question a lot. People just unsure about if they are or if they're not. So the students that are in the bargaining unit or in the potential bargaining unit would be getting the emails, but we recognize, if you're not receiving emails, it just leaves a question mark. So we will clarify that for folks and provide context about, according to our records, why you wouldn't be and what you could do if you believe that's an incorrect record.
Back.
I can't speak directly to that. Maybe the next speaker could address that question.
Yeah.
Are we elected, is it straight off paper, or is it,
I don't believe there's any Scantron. I believe it's simple. It's a paper ballot. There is a sample ballot that's available, and it's posted online, and there was a link to it in one of the messages that went out, but I'm sure you'll see more of the sample ballot.
So it's just in like a box?
I believe it's folded and placed in a box, yeah.
All right, any final questions? Todd?
The emails about eligibility, when can we expect those?
So the first round has already gone out, and there'll be at least one more reminder around polling places, so if you have any questions about eligibility, you can contact the graduate school. You could I imagine you could contact CGSU and ask them to make an inquiry as well. But you should receive, I believe the emails about ineligible voters will go out tomorrow. And again, if you haven't received messages specifically, you may be in the ineligible group. And if that's not the case, you would need to let us know.
All right.
So the unit is as a labor union is would be negotiating terms and conditions, hours and wages related to employment. And as we've defined it, employment is the assistantship responsibility. So the scope of what a union contract would include would be related to employment type terms and conditions. And would not directly cover academic issues, for example, that would apply to all graduate students, but is explicitly focused on terms and conditions of employment.
All right, we've got two final questions, Manisha, and then up to that.
So I think I remember reading about a bunch of different cases, but just to clarify, there are no absentee ballots for this election.
So the question about absentee ballots. There are two populations of students that can request absentee ballots by contacting AAA. One is any student who is currently registered in absentia for the spring semester. We provided a list to both CGSU and AAA have that list. We've agreed that any registered in absentia student can request an absentee ballot. Any student who is attending a conference or official Cornell workshop can also request an absentee ballot. The agreement is very clear that it defines the eligibility to participate in the election is based on students' current assistantship. But of course, we know that students move between fellowships and assistantships. An election would be binding on students who are just receiving admissions offers now, and of course, they won't have an opportunity to vote. So it's a valid question, but it is specifically for students with appointments this term.
All right. Thank you, Jason. And now we have Tyler McCann, liaison to the GPSA from GSU. Thanks, Tyler.
Sure. So I'm going to bring up Paul Berry here, who's going to help me answer some of these questions. And I also have Michaela in the audience, who I'm going to defer to for some of these technical questions. So first off, I want to thank GPSA for having us and allowing us to come and speak. I just want to say a few sentences, and then I would send a series of 11 questions that I was going to address. And I've been told that Nate will sort of run the show behind the scenes. So I wanted to say that workers across all industries have struggled and fought and worked to have union representation. Unions over history have gotten us things like a 40-hour work week, healthcare insurance, an end to child labor, things that seem totally absurd now to us that would ever have existed without that. So CGSU is wanting to join this proud history of organized labor to provide the grad community at Cornell with the right to assemble as workers and come to a decision about our treatment collectively. The union movement doesn't exist in isolation, but the rights and power of workers grow as unionization at any institution grows. So together with GPSA, we're aiming to increase the collective power of grad and professional students and workers and expand advocacy for our community. So with that, I'll get to the first question. So the first question is talking about how does CGSU justify the cost of AFT affiliation, specifically through dues. The person is citing that approximately $1 million are going to be leaving Cornell per year in dues from those within the bargaining unit. And with this money, we could afford several attorneys, paralegals, tax accountants, office space, et cetera. There is a hypothetical budget included to work with us when the contract negotiations come around. So for this question, I wanted to take a step back and look at sort of the logistics of the union campaign to just be recognized. So CGSU was created by an off-branch of GPSA members at the time with no affiliation. At one point, they decided that in order to complete their union drive successfully, they needed logistical support from a national affiliate. So they had lots of interviews. They chose AFT based on numerous things. And so the staff that's been provided to us by AFT for the past year and a half has ranged from 5 upwards of 20. So getting at this question of is this cost worth it? So part of the idea is that grads are very busy, right? We all know this point. So the idea that we can totally commit ourselves to this union drive doesn't make a lot of sense with the same commitments we have to teaching, to research, and to classwork that we're doing. So part of what AFT does is sort of fill in the cracks for us that we're not able to commit ourselves. They've also provided numerous training workshops on how to organize, how to continue being a helping hand to CGSU moving through in the future. They've shipped over grad union members from other institutions to talk with small groups of students about their experience at their own institutions. And I know that when I've been having conversations with my peers in plant science, it's been super useful that I've worked with an organizer because I can essentially have the conversation, tell her what the concerns I heard were, and then she just handles all of the database stuff, which is great. So with that said, there's also this really important idea of union dues, which is it's not just about our own institution, but that a national affiliate is extending our reach into the nation. So part of what's paying for the union drive here right now is dues that other member institutions have paid previously, and then moving forward into the future, our dues that we pay to help other institutions to pay for their union drive. I'm going to defer to Paul to say something.
Just one more thing on the dues and the large numbers. So, I mean, our bargaining unit is composed of roughly 2,000 people. So when the $1 million per year estimate is, we don't know the exact cost of dues, but it's roughly accurate in an aggregate number. But just to give some context, some numbers from the most recent Cornell budget I've seen from 2014.
question was, what guarantees do we have of independence in reference to AFP? So to answer this question, I pulled a block of text from an Illinois teachers local union, which is affiliated with AFP. The AFP has always maintained that locals should run their own union without interference from the national affiliate. This commitment is reflected in the diversity of AFP locals. This independence requires locals to maintain a working and active membership to accomplish their goals rather than relying on outside service organizations. Such activism creates stronger and more effective unions at the local level. So there are a few different cases where locals on the internet that are affiliated with AFT have posted something to this effect. Essentially, the rules of membership to have a relationship with AFT are we have to pay our dues on time. We can't segregate our membership, which sounds absurd, but it's from the 60s. And then also we can't steal money from within our own union, which makes sense. And the cool part about this autonomy, too, is that grad locals, so grad union locals, have actually pushed a lot of what AFT's agenda at the nationwide level is. So grad locals have been at the front of issues like paid family leave and trans worker protection. So it's nice to know that what we do here can actually influence national as well. Okay, so there was a question, the next question was about who will be in the room for negotiations. And this person wanted to know what happens if the students reject a deal that AFT's people negotiate, or what if AFT refuses to push what is important to CGSU body. So the good news is that AFT does not have the authority. The only people who get to approve and vote or not approve and vote on a contract are the graduate students within CGSU, the membership of CGC, which includes the bargaining unit. So what we will be provided in terms of people from AFT, we'll actually get someone from the state affiliate we have named NYSET, and that will be a negotiations expert within the realm of union negotiations. And essentially what their role is there will be a negotiating committee composed of elected grads who are representative of the fields that they represent, including international student representative. And they will go to that person and say, these are the outcomes that our membership wants. What's the best avenue to get these into a contract? They provide us guidance. We go into it. At no point does AFT or NYSET have the ability to influence whether we accept or not accept a contract. It's up to us. Paul, you want to say something?
Sure. And just one other, if you're interested in learning more about the bargaining and negotiating committee, there's a link on the front page of our newly redesigned website called Creating Our Negotiating Committee that is our best attempt to explain this process in quick and succinct terms. But basically, we're moving towards a democratic amendment procedure for creating the procedures by which our negotiating committee would be selected in the event that we win the election and move forward toward bargaining with Cornell, consistent with the agreement that Jason began by mentioning. Yeah.
The next question asks, in the event that negotiations break down with the administration, does the union strike? What would that strike look like, and what protections against loss of research progress would the union offer? So I get that this is a pretty scary thing. So I've never been part of a union, and the idea of a strike sounds a little ludicrous to me. But strikes are a tool that unions have, and they use it when the administration or the employer that they're working with refuses to cooperate in good faith, either in the negotiation process for a contract or in fulfilling the contract, what has already been stated. This isn't something that is invoked easily. It's not something that is sort of used carelessly, but this is something that only works if there's actual membership support of this. So the way that strikes work is if there's an issue that people think there's a strike, there would be a vote within the membership, and that vote would have to have a majority of support, not only because that's sort of like how the democracy should work, but also there is no rule, there's no law, there's no penalty which says that if you do not want to observe a strike that you can't. So if there's a strike going on and you don't want to do it or you can't do it because you're like me and you have to maintain your fungal cultures, that's fine. There are methods to still sort of observe or support, maybe you could wear a pin or something, while still maintaining the duty you have. This is a function that exists for nurses, so if a nurse has to provide life-saving service, but still there her union's on strike, she can choose to still go and work. 10 minutes, great, okay. An example of this, quick example is in 2012, the Chicago Teachers Union went on strike for 12 days to protest a trend of underfunding education in the area. They took 2 years to deliberate whether or not they wanted to go on strike. In that 2 years, they were talking with their teachers as members, they were talking with parents, and they were talking with city officials, and so then they held a vote at the end of those 2 years and finally went on strike for 12 days. This was the first strike that they had been on since 1986. So again, this reemphasizes the point that they don't happen frequently, and when they do happen, you need not only to be effective, but also because of sort of the democratic rule, you have to have a majority of support. Paul. Paul's got some questions, and I'm going to defer to him soon.
Right, so I'll take questions number 5 and 6. The fifth question was, is there a realistic set of workplace protections and collective bargaining goals that the union would accept? What would that agreement look like, roughly? So I think that one point here is that, as Tyler has emphasized, we have created an entirely member-driven organization with local autonomy. So you may have seen the bargaining survey where we've tried to started to survey the membership about things that people really want to be negotiated into a contract. And there are opportunities to get involved in the negotiating committee and shape, you know, how the organization goes forward, what sorts of things are bargained for. And again, as Tyler emphasized, no contract will be binding until the entire membership, you know, provided the union has achieved recognition, we would vote on any negotiated contract before it applies to anyone. But that said, I understand the desire to hear more concrete goals. So there are a number on the issues page of our union website, in addition to like more general discussion with specific examples around our three kind of core goals and values: fairness, respect, and democracy. But just to itemize a few concrete goals that other unions have made, and there's more detailed information about other unions on our website, but here are a couple. One of our big issues is childcare. We have seen some improvements in recent years, but talking to student parents, without getting into numbers and specifics, there's much more that we can negotiate for our student parents. Dependent health care coverage currently costs $2,500 for a spouse, $5,000 and change for two or more children. You know, given our roughly $30,000 a year stipend,
spoken with. The resolution specifically cites changes to late-stage tuition rates prior to its implementation, TARA stipend rates prior to their approval, which is what Paul was talking about, the $350 fee for students not enrolled in the student health insurance plan. Grad students weren't allowed to participate in the workers' compensation working group forums after the 2014 resolution, so things have been mentioned. So someone writes, we are not currently in a state of emergency. Most grad students have positive experiences in clinical. The grad school has shown a willingness to try and help, and some faculty try to have a positive influence on the more problematic students. Yeah, this is great, right? So this trend that's been going on recently where we've been getting increased benefits, this is great. Why are any of us opposed to this? There's also no reason why that trend has to change when we have a contract. So a contract, again, as Paul just mentioned, is setting a minimum, and Cornell can treat us above that however they wish to. So I'm really sort of pleased at what I've seen recently by the grad school, and I think it shows the commitment to good outcomes for both grads and from the administration. We don't have to be enemies. That's not our goal. We're all Cornell enemies. Okay, I'm going to turn Paul real quickly because we're out of time.
Sorry. Just to point out, and not to repeat myself, but I mean, the state of emergency is a relative term, and for our graduate parents, for folks who are working in very hazardous environments with substandard protections, I mean, I think we're in as much the serious situation is as it has always been, which is not very good. I'll yield the floor.
So given that many grad students feel that they have been dismissed and harassed by union organizers or CPSC members, what, if any, procedures would the union have to ensure that all voices are heard? So for this, I'd want to say, first, CGSU has three main principles: fairness, respect, and democracy. So tag. Second of all, I want to apologize personally and on behalf of the organization for anyone that feels dismissed in interactions. I know that personalities and feelings flare up, especially during organizing campaigns for an organization to essentially be established and to create itself. So personally, I hope that that has never happened between me and anyone in this room or anyone in the body of the grad school. But that will go away because it's my understanding if our tagline is true to ourselves, which I believe it is, and I'm confident that it is, that this is our constituency, right? We are all grad students, so we have a commitment to not piss each other off.
Sure.
So, yeah, if you're interested in asking a question, just raise your hand and I'll recognize you.
My question is about the commitment to striking only in the case of feeling like the employer is acting in bad faith, and whether that is something that's binding or whether that is a tool that would probably only be employed in bad faith. But before you answer that, I just have to point out that the comparison between millions of dollars being spent by the university is that's coming out of the university pocket and not individual graduate student pocket. So I'm a law student. It's false equivalence. Go ahead.
I like to respond to that, though. I don't think that it's such false equivalence. I mean, we're all creating value for the institution that's being spent and appropriated in various ways. So just I don't think that it's so self-evident that the equivalent is so false. I mean, that comparison was made to provide some context to the number of $1 million distributed amount around our entire bargaining unit. And bargaining unit works, as employees of the university.
Can I answer the first part of the question, though?
Yeah, if you want to go back.
Yeah. So the first part of the question is that in the contract there will be a clear process by which you have to follow negotiations, and then if negotiations fall through, then a strike can be considered.
So you mentioned a lot about how post-election, if CJU voted in, there will be a lot of voting on how we structure the organization, and I'm wondering are there currently existing governing documents about how internal voting systems will work?
Yes. So the documents, the Constitution, and are there bylaws? Okay. So the Constitution and bylaws are available on the CGSU website.
I can speak to that.
Okay. So I'm going to defer very quickly.
Yeah. So can I just rely on the CGSU website? So the bylaws do exist. There is potential. Currently, there's one amendment being put forward that would instruct the bargaining committee and show the election process for that. But members are also welcome to submit other ones and make comments on that. So the
board member, and I just like to say, you know, as we move forward and hopefully build this organization, you know, the expertise that everyone in this room has contributed, you know, to creating a well-functioning, procedurally running organization is things we should continue to utilize moving forward.
Yeah.
The previous
response
was negotiating committee was messy, bargaining committee. Do we know what the amendment is about who constitutes the bargaining?
So, can I get Yeah, so you can contact me directly at TBM45. Paul, do you want to be?
Sure.
Okay.
PGB52. And also another point, we're going to have an info session Friday afternoon, 3:30 to 5, with our best attempt to come up with an accessible time, and that will kind of lead into the Big Red Barn. We'll have people there. I will certainly be there to answer questions at Friday, you know, going 5 to 7, I'll be at the Big Red Barn. Official Q&A, 3:30 to 5, location we're working on. We tried to get this room, it's not available, but we're working on that, and it will certainly be announced as much as possible.
And could you also CC me on that, so that I can put those questions and those responses together so the entire assembly can see them?
So you want written responses to all these questions?
Well, are you going to respond?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Which I regret to inform you that I have so far failed to accomplish, was to bring back a law professor to talk to the assembly about workers' compensation. There isn't one who can do that. The one professor who has relevant expertise responded to my request by recusing herself, citing a conflict of interest. She did not elaborate. This is not surprising because the nature of the conflict of interest, it would probably make it impossible for her to explain what it is. She referred me to Professor Lee Adler in the ILR school. He is a very busy individual, and told me that he could not meet with the assembly.
He told me that he could not meet with the assembly due to his schedule constraints. I asked him if it would be all right with him if I took notes during our conversation.
Can you speak up? I can't hear you.
Yes. For those of you who know me, I'm a parliamentary nut. Please, next time, just phrase it as a point of privilege. instead of just, you know, yelling. I asked him if he would be all right with me taking notes on our conversation, writing them up, passing them by him for approval, and presenting them to the assembly, not really as my words, but as his. So we had our conversation. I took notes. He was totally on board with this. I took notes. It was a very cordial, informative conversation. I wrote those notes up into a presentation and text, and I sent them to him. And shortly before the meeting, he told me that he would not endorse them, and that what he endorsed was my statement that this presentation contained impressions that I received from my meeting with him. I should note in passing that he is still a practicing lawyer. I don't know what about my my write-up he found objectionable, as he declined to comment in any way specifically about what his objections were to my write-up, and he also declined to see a revised write-up that might meet his standards more clearly. But I have no reason to believe that anything that he told me was inaccurate, and we.
supposed to be like, hey, thanks, he helped us out. But now if you see him, yeah, you know what to do. No, seriously, I wouldn't, because he actually mentioned in our conversation that he's been involved in union activity for a long time. He's been involved in representing unions a lot, and he definitely implied that he got in some fistfights representing coal mining unions in West Virginia. So I don't know if that's true, but he can probably take you. So a little bit of background information just to start out, because not everybody here, I think, has a background in labor law and in the nature of workers' compensation. I don't exactly want to say I do either, but I did take first-year torts, and I did work in HR for a while, so this is what you got. Okay. Workers' compensation is a grand bargain between employees and employers. Back in the battle days, basically, if you got squished by an ox cart on the job, your options were cry about it or pursue an action in tort. And that basically means that you have to demonstrate that your employer committed some act of wrongdoing, probably just negligence, which is to say that they did not take reasonable risks. Please do not ask me to explain reasonable, because I will, and then you'll regret it. Expensive and time-consuming for both sides. You had to actually get a lawyer up and go through a trial and all that fun stuff, discovery, deposition, the whole nine yards. The employee faced a chance that they would recover nothing. The judge might say, "Oh, I'm sorry, your employer, this is also kind of before OSHA. Your employer didn't, do a great job of providing workplace protection, but they weren't actually negligent, so you get to cry about it." There's also a chance that the recovery against the employer would be so great that they went bankrupt. This is not necessarily good for the employee who is injured or for other employees. There also exists in law what we call the judgment-proof defendant, which is to say they are flat broke. And a judge can say, "Oh, you now have to pay $1 million in medical expenses." They can say, "I don't have $1 million." And again, the employee gets to go cry. So, not a great state of affairs. Then, as it so frequently does, the regulatory state saves the day. Modern workers' compensation is a no-fault system. If you can show that you were injured on the job in the course of your employment, then nobody asks whether your employer messed up. You just get money, which is great. Money is great. Streamlined process run by specialists who actually work in labor law and are familiar with what counts as scope and course of employment, are familiar with the kind of actions that happen on the job and what medical bills will realistically be. The recovery is predictable for the employee and the employer, so the employer knows they won't go bankrupt if they get a couple of claims here and there. If they get enough claims that it becomes a financial problem, clearly they have an additional problem they need to solve. But the employee knows that they're going to get money. It's going to be scheduled, predictable, a paycheck replacement, right? That's great. And insurance is required by law, so you don't have your judgment-proof defendant. If a company wants to have employees at all, it has to pay insurance so that there is money available to be paid out of workers' compensation to replace the wages of employees who are injured. Workers' compensation, fun for the whole family. Okay, what do you need in order to recover the workers' comp? So you got to be an employee. Now, this would be great if it was really straightforward. Surprise, it's not. Basically, every law has that talks about what an employee is has different requirements for what constitutes an employee. So, for example, Title VII, which is the federal employment civil rights law, basically says that to be an employee, you have to be receiving a full time. You have to be a paycheck. Receiving a paycheck, you don't have to be necessarily full time, but the grounds of your employment have to be pretty straightforward. So it's relatively hard to show, for Title VII civil rights purposes, that you're an employee rather than an independent contractor. The NLRA, which is what the NLRB operates under, which is the body everybody usually okay with it as is. And neither side can actually bind the workers' compensation board. So his expressed belief was that if a union and a university were to agree that any injury that occurred to a graduate student who was in a employer-employee relationship with the university was a workplace accident, that the workers' compensation board would simply be like, no, that's not true, because it's a state law that governs what's compensable under workers' comp. And so there's not bargaining to be done on that issue. Okay, yeah, I'm almost done. They can stipulate to things, and there are a whole bunch of things that they can stipulate to, and he is not aware of any union that has bargained with its employer in its contract about workers' comp, because again, it's just like it's separate from the employer and the employee. The state runs it. And Cornell self-insures, so the money would be coming from the same place anyway, regardless of who's paying it out. Things the GPSA can do from here. Information. This was written before he told me that he didn't endorse my thing and didn't want to look at another thing. So maybe no follow-up questions for Professor Adler, and then I can send them to him. I don't know if we're going to get answers. On the immigration question, or sorry, the question for international students, that's an immigration law question. I am happy to follow up with Professor Yale Lehrer at the law school, which is whom Professor Adler recommended I follow that up with. We can get in other speakers. I know Paul Berry mentioned getting in contact with somebody from the New York State Workers' Compensation Board. I am happy to go talk to them and see if they will schlep out here and have a chat with us. Actually, within Cornell, the GPSA, right, my understanding is that Resolution 10 is currently more shaping up to be a request for a clarified kind of step-by-step, maybe a flowchart. Flowcharts are great, of the process for trying to get workers' comp for a graduate student injury. Professor Adler suggested that maybe the GPSA provide like one trained person, which is probably all that we would need for the number of serious injuries at Cornell, like one or two people who are like trained in this procedure who can be advocates for people who are pursuing a workers' comp claim. Or, you know, GPSA can lobby to get policy 1.5 changed. That's if we feel that that's a use of our labor that's not being recompensed. Actually, outside Cornell, NAGPS, the National Association of Graduate Professional Students, that they do federal law lobbying. So does Cornell. You could also resolve that the Cornell Federal Relations Team bug the federal government about this, or the state government. That was the end. The only thing I want to say is that I think right now I personally would be pretty reluctant to move for a change in the status quo that would get individual graduate student research toward degree recognized as work, because I think it would be hard to say what the ramifications of that would be, and it is important to keep in mind that Cornell is not judgment proof, and as a result, if you get hurt doing your own research and you can show that it was because of Cornell's negligence, they could theoretically be on the hook for an awful lot of money. You're not going to get that out of workers' comp. Workers' comp is scheduled out. You're going to get what you get, what's awarded by the workers' comp board. It's very predictable. So the whole point of the grand bargain is, like, just keep in mind your options are, on the one hand, certainty, but a lower sum, and on the other hand, uncertainty, but potentially a very high sum, and either way, the law kind of is what it is. Questions? I do not promise I will be able to answer them, but I will do my best.
All right, we're gonna do two quick questions, and we'll go Paul, because I saw your hand first, and then we'll shoot up.
understanding is that so far they have not, except in one case in which they were actually really contesting the employer-employee relationship at all. Is that correct, Jason? Okay, thank you. So, again, it hasn't happened.
The answer is it is not going to. Probably.
So, if you...
He's not a lawyer, so, just keep in mind.
Yes. So if you hire an attorney to represent you to the Workers' Compensation Board, no. Cornell is under no legal obligation to pay your attorney fees. On the other hand, you should be aware that the Workers' Compensation Board frequently provides assistance up to a certain point navigating the procedure from other worker compensation judges who aren't hearing your individual case. So it's not that you are completely on your own for assistance in the process. In regard to your second question, I don't feel qualified to answer your question about whether two-thirds of lost wages is like morally sufficient to satisfy the like broader compact between employers and employees. And if you press me to give an answer, I would say smash the state. Like, modern neoliberal capitalism is broken. There's no question about that. Like, but that, those are my personal views, and you're not going to see them reflected in New York State law anytime soon, or certainly not in federal law, I don't think.
Okay, so I'm gonna slow you down. I think he answered your question, and so
yeah.
Like, so
Thank you. This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.